Well, if you have a Bible with you, let's open them up to Nehemiah chapter 1. If not, the words will be up on the screen here in a few minutes for you. At Grace, if you're new here, you may not know this. At Grace, we have four different campuses, so we are a multi-site church, which simply means we don't just have one location. We actually have four different locations, and in an effort to reach different parts of East Texas, we have a location in Lindale, one that meets also on the Old Jacksonville Road. We have an Hispanic campus that meets on the Old Jacksonville Road as well, and then we have, obviously, the campus here at University Boulevard. And what we do is, as different campuses, we actually try to preach throughout the entire year together, meaning that we plan out, well in advance, we plan out every Sunday what the passage is that will be preached at all four locations. And we work together as a preaching team, which is such a great benefit and encouragement to one another, that where we prepare sermons together. They're very unique because you have different personalities preaching at each campus, but it's still the same passage. And even though we try to be on the same schedule, we also try to carve out some time throughout the year and the freedom that if there is something going on that's a trend at each campus, or maybe just specifically to one campus, we can step out of our current sermon series, and we have the freedom as campus pastors to address an issue that we may be seeing at our campus. And I share that with you this morning because I feel like this morning is one of those times that we need to step out of our current sermon series, which is through the book of Acts, and we need to step into Nehemiah chapter 1 because I've seen a trend, and here's the trend for us. I've heard through multiple conversations over the last 3 to 4 weeks just a lot of weariness here at our campus, a lot of tiredness at our campus, a lot of the feeling of, man, I certainly am not thriving right now. We're surviving at best. I've heard a lot of, we're just trying to get our head above water right now. Or I've heard a lot of, we're just walking through a very stressful time. It's a very stressful time. Or I've heard some of this too, of feeling the weight of taking on the burden of other people's sins, people that you love, maybe family members or close friends, and the sin that they're walking through in their life, and you're feeling the effects of that. And so what I want to do this morning is to step out of Acts and go to Nehemiah 1, and I think we can find some good comfort this morning and some also a real good challenge for us as well. About how do we walk through the mess of life, the stress in life as a young family to where you're like, man, we're just trying to get a full night's sleep right now. We certainly are not thriving. Or how do you work through the mess of life as a college student to where you're taking 18 hours, you have a full-time job, or maybe you play athletics at UT Tyler or TJC or somewhere like that, and that in itself is a full-time job, and so you're just feeling the crunch of that. How, as a young professional, as you're trying to think through, what is the next step in life? Like, where does God want me? Is he going to keep me single and in Tyler all of my life? Or what's next? Like, is there a next? Our career, what is next? Or maybe you as a parent right now, it is one step forward and not two steps back in parenting. It's like 4 or 5 steps back, you feel like. And you're just feeling the stress and the crunch of parenting right now. So here's the question I want to pose to us. In the midst of the weariness, the tiredness, the stress, the surviving, how is your prayer life right now? And your answer may be, it's non-existent. Your answer may be simply, I'm not running to the Lord in the midst of the stress and the weariness. Your answer may be, it's very frustrating right now because I have prayed and God is not doing his end of the bargain. At least I don't feel like he is. Or maybe your answer is, I'm just numb. I'm just numb right now. So I'm not really praying anything. And I think that's so important to us to understand that in the midst of the stress and the weariness and all that goes on in life, that God has given us an incredible gift. It's called prayer. And what we see here in Nehemiah chapter 1, and the reason I want to take us to Nehemiah chapter 1 is because Nehemiah, in the midst of an immense amount of pain and weariness and stress that he experiences in life, what does he do? He prays. And I think there's a lot we can learn and be challenged by from Nehemiah chapter 1. So let's go into it this morning. Nehemiah chapter 1. Let's first look at what was Nehemiah's struggle. What was the weariness? What was the stress that he was walking through? And for us to understand and kind of wrap our minds around the stress that he was walking through, we have to understand the context of his life. And to understand the context of his life, it means for the next 3 to 4 minutes, we need to have an Old Testament history lesson. Y'all ready? Let's go. History buffs, you'll love this. Non-history buffs, you're going to hate me for the next 3 to 4 minutes. But here we go. So if you date back the history of the Hebrew people, it goes all the way back, and it has its roots found in Abraham. And Abraham lived roughly 2000 BC. And kind of a side note, it's very interesting that three of the world's major religions all trace their heritage back to Abraham. Judaism, obviously, Christianity, and Islam all trace their heritage back to this man, Abraham. So again, he lived roughly 2000 BC, and if you fast forward about 1,000 years down the road, you come to what's called the Kingdom Era for the Hebrew people, for the Jewish people. Now, the Kingdom Era means that they were simply led by kings. The first one was King Saul. The second king for them was King David, the one that we know a lot about. He had a son named Solomon. Solomon was a king, but after Solomon's reign, we see that internal fighting takes place within the Hebrew people. It wasn't external forces that came in. It was actually internal fighting, and they divide into two kingdoms, into a northern kingdom, which is called Israel. So out of the 12 tribes of Israel, 10 went into the northern kingdom, and then two went down to the south and established a southern kingdom known as Judah. So Israel, northern kingdom, southern kingdom, Judah. Well, what takes place throughout the coming years is very interesting. In Israel, they have bad king after bad king after bad king. And people stray away from the Lord. And then at 722 BC, a military force arises known as Assyria. And Assyria comes in, and what do? They invade the northern kingdom of Israel, and they demolish Israel. Some of the people in Israel actually were able to migrate down south, and they lived in Judah for the next 300 years. That Judah rolls on even after Israel was wiped out until the late 500s. And then Judah is actually invaded by a military force known as the Babylonians. They were led by a king named, anybody want to help me out? Think VeggieTales, okay? VeggieTales here. Nebuchadnezzar, some of you guys were raised, you're VeggieTale babies, okay? You were raised on VeggieTales, you should know this, even though they messed up his name. So Nebuchadnezzar is the king of Babylon, and they invade Judah. And what happens during that time, I wish we had more time really to go into this, but if you go back to 2 Chronicles, the end of it, I think chapter 37 gives you great detail about what happened when the Babylonians went into Judah. And then not only did they go into Judah, but they demolished the main city, which is Jerusalem. And when they demolished Jerusalem, they burned artifacts. They crushed the security around the city, which was the wall of Jerusalem. They also invade the temple, the worship place for the Hebrews, where they can go and they can worship God. That they demolished the temple. And not only did they demolish the temple and burn artifacts and demolish the protection of the city and all that was in the city, they took the people of Judah and they held them captive and they sent them back to Babylon. Now here's the crazy part of this. We think, oh, they went from Jerusalem to Babylon a couple of miles down the road, maybe from Tyler to Lindale. Here's the problem. Jerusalem to Babylon would be almost the equivalent of Tyler to Denver. Tyler to Denver, and guess what? They didn't fly. They didn't ride a Greyhound bus. There was no train. There was no transportation. What did they do? They walked from Tyler to Denver almost. I'm sure the whole time they were saying, and I would walk 500. I'm sorry, that has just been in my head all morning. I didn't share that at 9:30. Your special 11, that's just for you guys, all right? They walked 800 miles to this place. And they were exiled there in Babylon. And so here is the people of God, and you have one of the core figures of the people of God, which is Nehemiah, and we get this glimpse in this one chapter of how difficult this was for this man and the people of God. That back home, home is no more. Home is demolished. You're living in a foreign country now where you do not want to be, and it's been hard to travel all the way there. Do you think that he's walking through pain and suffering and struggles in life? Absolutely he is. So the question becomes, what did Nehemiah and the people of God do? Get bitter and angry at God? Turn away from God? No, they prayed. They prayed. So what did this prayer look like? What does it look like to pray in a healthy, good way in the midst of your struggles in life? Let's learn from this man. So here we go, Nehemiah chapter 1. Let's start in verse 4. This is the first thing that we learn from Nehemiah. In the midst of his pain and his struggles, how does he pray? The first way he prays is this. In the midst of your struggles, we can learn from Nehemiah that prayer is foremost. The prayer is foremost. Look at verse 4. As soon as I heard these words, in other words, what I heard about what took place back in Jerusalem and in Judea, when he heard of all the destruction, all that took place, I sat down and I wept and I mourned for days. Do you feel the weight of what this man was walking through? I sat down and I wept and I mourned. For how long? Days. Days. But then look in the next part here. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. I love this here. Because in the midst of his pain and his struggles and the suffering that Nehemiah and the people of God are walking through, and how difficult that was, he says, I continued praying and fasting. So what we learn here from Nehemiah is that prayer was not like this some latch dish effort that he just had to go to in the midst of his pain and struggles and suffering. He continued to pray. He was praying before the struggle. And then when the struggle came along, he continued to pray out and cry out to the Lord. Nehemiah understood this, that prayer is a first response, not a last resort. That the gift of prayer that God has given us is always a first response. It's not a last resort, even though oftentimes we treat it that way. I think Nehemiah understood that prayer and the way that God designed prayer was not just simply as a tool for us to cry out to God to get us out of bad situations in life. That the primary function of prayer is not only something we do when things go wrong, or it's not just simply our avenue to tell God this is the way he should be doing things and he needs to get that back to us and done by noon. Prayer is a gift from God that is to be used in the midst when things are going great. And it's also a gift from God to be used even when things are not going great and the struggles of life overwhelm us. For Nehemiah, prayer was not an emergency flare that he just had to shoot up to God. No, it simply was a lifeline of communication between him and God that he had been in before, long before the struggle came. I like to illustrate it this way. So I never forget three different days of my life. Each day was the day that I saw one of my sons for the first time. They're in the operating room, and when Eli, Nate, and Thad, when I was able to lay eyes on them for the first time, I remember I just felt something that I'd never felt before. And the only way I can explain it was there was a love for each one of these boys that I didn't even know existed. And it's funny because I started thinking about, like, well, why did I love them? Why? Because they certainly, to that point, had not done anything to deserve my love. And you might be, man, you're like cold-hearted. Well, let me build a little case for you here, okay? They came out screaming at me. For the next several days, all they did was poop. And they didn't let me sleep for the next 3 years of my life. And they cost me an astronomical amount of money. So, like, what is their resume or portfolio for why I should love them? It's nothing. But there was something ingrained in me that just said, I don't care about all that stuff. I love them. I love them. And for Kara and I, we begin to communicate with our boys, I mean, from day one. And then as their communication skills developed over time, they were communicating to us. And I was able to, we try our best to communicate more and more, like how much we love these three boys. And they try to communicate sometimes better than others. As boys, sometimes we have to be like, use your words. Okay? Use your words. But to communicate back to us that they love us. I can't imagine, here's my point, I can't imagine what it would be like if our boys only communicated to us and spoke with us only when they needed something. That would be tough as a parent. That only when they needed mom and dad to get them out of a jam in life, then they came back and communicated to us. They only talked to us when things weren't going right. Because what I've learned over time through my relationship with the Lord is that God has a parental love for us. And a parental relationship with us as well. And we as a child of God, a son or daughter of God, have a privilege. It's called prayer. And it's not just something that we use when we try to get us out of a bad, difficult situation at all. Prayer has to be primary. It has to be foremost. That's what we see first with Nehemiah. Prayer was just something Nehemiah did, even in the good or the bad. But what else do we learn from this man here? We also learned that in the midst of your struggles, to pray reverently. We learn from Nehemiah that in the midst of our struggles, we are to pray reverently. Look at verse 5 with me, if you will. Check out verse 5. And here, this is the beginning of his prayer, by the way. And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. You know what blows me away here in verse 5 in the beginning of his prayer? You know what Nehemiah doesn't do? He doesn't jump straight into, God, this is what I need you to do for me. He actually doesn't even give his request to the Lord until verse 11. And his prayer starts in verse 5. That may be a little bit of a paradigm shifting moment for you right now when you regard to prayer and as you think about prayer. Look, what does this man pray for? How does he start his prayer out? He starts his prayer out by simply worshiping God. He worships God. What does he do? He begins to call out who God is, and he's reminded of who it is he is speaking with. Christians, do you ever stop and consider who it is you're about to talk to when you open your mouth and begin to pray? I mean, really, do you stop and just consider for a moment, this is who I am about to speak with? This is it. That's exactly what Nehemiah does here. So how many of you did foolish things when you were in junior high? Come on. All right, that should be everyone in the room. Thank you. I call it my foolish years. A lot of things I can't share from the pulpit that went on during those years. There are a few things I guess I can share. But one of the foolish things I did during junior high was I became aware of my mom and dad's first name. And this is what I mean. My best friend, he started calling his mom by her first name when he was in junior high. And she actually went by her middle name. She had a first name that she didn't like, but he thought he would take it a step further, and he was really cool. He actually had her first name printed on the back of a shirt, and he wore the shirt around all the time. That was awesome. Well, I saw that, and I thought, oh, maybe I can call my mom and dad by their first name. Exactly. So I came home from school one day. My dad said, hey, son, how was your day? And I said, well, it's good, Bob. My dad looked at me and said, well, why'd you just call me? I go, Bob, that's your name. Like, I'm in seventh grade. I'm awesome. And he said, well, my name is Dad to you. And he went on to inform me there are only two people in this world who have the privilege of calling him Dad. That would be me and my sister. And I was like, that's great, Bob. And I'll never forget the look on my dad's face. And it wasn't that he was disturbed. He wasn't disturbed because he was reverent and he was this reverent figure. That wasn't it. It wasn't because he wanted me to be real proper. I think my dad was disturbed and discouraged because his son, me, had just forfeited my privilege to know him for who he is, my dad. Like, I was foolish to forfeit my privilege to know him as my dad. And I think sometimes when we pray, we don't even stop and consider who it is we're about to talk to. I mean, just look at what Nehemiah does at the beginning of his prayer. He starts it out and he says, this is in verse 5 alone. God, you are the God of heaven. God, you are great and awesome. God, you are faithful. God, your love is unconditional. That's all in verse 5. That's only one line of his prayer. And he has already said, God, this is who you are. You're the God of heaven. You're great and awesome. You're faithful. Your love is unconditional for me. And we have the privilege, too, in prayer of crying out and saying, God, you're infinitely wise. God, you're infinitely powerful. God, you're sovereign, which means you're in control. That somehow in your sovereignty, you're able to take our choices, work them out for our good and your glory in the midst of your sovereignty. That's amazing. That in prayer, we're able to cry out, God, you are infinitely gracious. That the one that we are about to speak to in prayer is infinitely generous. He is sustaining. That is the God that we're able to cry out to in prayer, but oftentimes we go straight into, God, here's a list of things I need you to take care of and be done with that by noon. Here's the problem. We should never go to God to prayer. We should never go to God in prayer because he is useful. We should go to God in prayer because he is simply God. We don't go to God in prayer because he's useful. We run to him in prayer because he is simply God. And what I have learned in walking with the Lord now is that what I pray for always reflects what I believe to be true about who God is. Just take a look at what you pray for and how you pray. That will tell you everything you need to know about who you believe God is and what he is like. So Nehemiah shows us that prayer has to be foremost. Nehemiah shows us that we, when we pray, we have to pray reverently to the Lord and understand who it is we're talking to. But he also shows us something else here. He shows us that in the midst of our struggles, we have to pray honestly. We have to pray honestly. Look down in verse 6 with me, if you will. In this prayer, Nehemiah says, let your ear be attentive and your eyes be open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. What I love about Nehemiah's prayer here is that he acknowledges the fact that that his people are a people who have run from the Lord, who have turned from the Lord, who have turned to things of this world, who have not believed God to be who he truly is, who have not worshiped God with a life of worship. And so he confesses, this is our sin, Lord. We're just laying it out before you. But he doesn't stop with other people's sin. Here it is. He makes it personal. He makes it personal. In that last line, he says, even I and my Father's house have sinned. So he opens up his life to the Lord and he says, God, here I am. Like, here I am. Nehemiah is not playing games with the Lord. He's not kind of sharing half-truths, sharing a little bit of this and holding a little bit of that back. He is laying his life out before the Lord and saying, God, let's be honest. Like, here I am. And I believe this is something actually King David got, and this is one of my favorite psalms, Psalms 139, verses 1 and 2, when David just cries out before the Lord. He says, you have searched me and you know me. That's a pretty honest and authentic statement. You are familiar with all of my ways. He goes on to say, if I made my bed in the depths, you were there, God. If I rose up to the heavens, you would be there, God. If I ride on the wings of the dawn or sail along the far sides of the sea, even there, your hand will hold me tight. Even there, your hand will guide me. You are there. What David just says is, God, I can't outrun you. I can't hide from God. You know me. And in the midst of you knowing me, I am inviting you to search the depths of my heart. We want to be authentic. That's authenticity. That's being authentic. Of laying your life out before the Lord through prayer and saying, God, here I am. God, I'm struggling right now. God, I'm angry right now. God, I'm numb right now. God, these are the thoughts going through my head. These are the lies I'm buying into right now, Lord. Like, this is me, God. God, you're not going to cast me away because I'm being honest. You're not going to send me to the corner and say, stand over there, disobedient one. Your grace surrounds me, and because your grace surrounds me right now, I can be completely honest before the Lord. Love is honesty. So Nehemiah prays first and foremost. He prays reverently and he prays honestly. And then the final one is this. He shows us that in the midst of your struggles, in the midst of our struggles, we have to pray surrendered. We have to pray surrendered. Look down in verse 11 with me, if you will. This is his conclusion to his prayer. He says, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name. Give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. As I mentioned earlier, the prayer starts in verse 5. He does not get to his request until verse 11, what we just read. But even in the midst of making his request to the Lord, he adopts a title, an identity for himself. Did you notice what he calls himself here in the midst of the prayer? God's servant. Nehemiah refers to himself several times here. I'm just God, I'm your servant. I'm your servant. And what that tells us is that Nehemiah, in calling himself servant, is simply saying to God, God, I surrender it all to you. God, I'm laying my request out to you, God. I'm being honest with you. I'm asking that you would move in this way, but at the end of the day, I'm surrendering it to you, because no servant goes to his master and says, this is how we're doing it. That doesn't work out. But instead, Nehemiah humbles his heart and he steps back and he goes, Lord, your ways and your thoughts and your plans are so far greater than mine. So all I can do is be your servant and surrender my will to your will now. God, I'm surrendered to you. Is that where you find yourself right now as you walk through weariness, tiredness, difficulties, survival, stress, pain, hurt? As you cry out to the Lord, are you surrendering it to Him through prayer? I think you got to ask yourself that question this morning. Because here's the reality. The reality is this, is that God's the only one who is in control of your circumstances. He's the only true sovereign one. You're not. You certainly are not. I am not. He is. Or maybe as you're trying to figure out what the next step in your life is, He's the one, the one who knows what exactly you need and where you need to be next. As you're a young family, young parent, you're trying to just survive right now. Do you realize God is the only one who can work good out of your circumstances? He's the only one that can do so. As you struggle with tiredness and weariness, and you feel like God needs to provide for you, do you understand that He is the only one that can provide in the most perfect, sufficient way for you? Even when you think you have it figured out how He should provide, come on. He knows so much better than you do. And He's much more faithful than you are and I am. He knows. So I'll conclude with this. I wasn't here last Sunday because my family and I traveled to Oklahoma to be there to celebrate the life of an aunt that I was really close to, my mom's sister. So we went back to celebrate her life, and I got a phone call from my mom sharing with me that my aunt's family actually wanted me to speak at her memorial service. So you may hear that and you may think, well, that's not a big deal, you're a pastor, that's fine, right? But here's where this is a very unique opportunity for me. I grew up Catholic. I'm the first one on either side of my family not to go to a Catholic church. This certainly is not an indictment upon Catholicism at all, but what I've learned is that Protestant pastors don't often get asked to speak at a Catholic mass. I'm a Protestant pastor, by the way. So when my mom shared this with me, I was like, really? Are you sure about this? You sure the Father O'Neill, who's the priest of the parish that I grew up in, is he okay with this? And she said, yeah, he's quite okay with it. He would love for you to speak. And I felt like it was a great opportunity that God provided, not because I'm a Protestant pastor and it's a Catholic mass. I was excited about the opportunity because even though many of my family members attend a Catholic church, most of them, with a handful of maybe two or three, most of them have just ignored the gospel and don't believe in the gospel. Not because they're Catholic. I know a lot of Baptists and Grace Communityites, I don't know what we're called here, by the way, but something like that, who don't believe the gospel. Churches are full of people who do not believe the gospel, I believe. I felt like God gave me an opportunity to just celebrate my aunt's life and then to share about her hope in Jesus and to briefly just lay the gospel out to my family members. So as we went, sat down at the pew, Eli and Nate were with me sitting out the same pew that I was in. And I knew my time to go up and share was coming. And all of a sudden, I became very, just overwhelmingly nervous. And it had nothing to do with public speaking. That's kind of what I do for a living. It had everything to do with, I knew the people that would be sitting in the pews before me have known me from birth. They knew me prior to my relationship with Christ. A lot of them view me simply as the religious fanatic who's a little bit too into Jesus. That's who they see me as. And I looked down at my shirt. My shirt was just going like this because my heart was racing so fast. I turned to Eli and Nate and I said, hey, would you guys pray for your dad? So I'm crazy nervous right now. I saw both their heads bow and they began to pray for their dad right there. And I begin to pray as well. And I just pray to the Lord. It's the Lord, I'm nervous. And the reason I'm nervous is because they know me. Also, I'm nervous because I'm about to share the gospel before them. I'm also nervous because I want their approval more than anything. I want them to look at me and to think, oh, wow, he's really done something with his life. I'm nervous I'm going to get up there and I'm going to fumble over my words. I'm nervous about all of this, God. And God just brought me to this point of surrender, of saying, God, here it is. I surrender it to you. So God, I don't care what they think about me when I walk out of this church. God, I don't care if I fumble over my words. Oh, well. God, I want to celebrate my aunt's life and I want to share the gospel right now. So you know what? All that matters is what you choose to do in me and through me. Speak, God. And here's the coolest part. This overwhelming peace just came upon me. I think God gave me that peace because that's exactly where he wanted me, was at a place of surrender. Saying, God, here it is. Like, I'm not telling you what to do right now, God. I'm just saying, I am your servant like Nehemiah was. Your ways are better than mine. Do what you want to do, God. And I believe when we're walking through the weariness, the pain, the difficulty of life, whatever that looks like in your life, the beauty is that through prayer, oftentimes God breaks us, and he breaks us out of his love. He's not mad at us, but out of his love, he chooses to break us down to this point of complete surrender, to where we, like Nehemiah, can say, God, I'm your servant. I'm not your counselor, God. I'm not the sovereign one in this relationship. You are. I am your servant. I surrender it through prayer.